And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where it's quarantine time and there's no NBA, so we're just getting all kinds of different guests on. And I am thrilled to be joined by a comedian, actor, producer, writer, who has two podcasts, is in every TV show that you've ever watched. And I think Simmons would describe you, my old boss, Bill Simmons, would describe this guest as a, what does he call it? The guy who always just brings stuff to the table and takes nothing off the table. That is Paul Scheer. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good. Well, I'm excited to be here. I was bummed because I really wanted to come on your show in the middle of the NBA season. I feel like we'd be right about playoffs now. We could talk about the Clippers. It would be really exciting. But now all we can do is really just kind of talk about each other's like NBA 2K teams and just be like, what's going on there?
We're going to talk about a lot of things, including the Clippers. But I mean that when you pop on the screen and you've been on, I mean, 30 Rock. Have you done Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
I have done Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
I thought so. I just saw you in the final episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes.
Whenever you're on the screen, I have this moment where I turn to my wife and I'm like, all right, this is about to get 5% better. It's never going to get 5% worse. It's always going to get a little better.
I appreciate that. I'll take that 5%. I really, I'll really embrace that.
You have two young sons.
Yes.
What parenting strategies have you and your wife, June Diane Raphael, also very funny, and your podcast co-host on How Did This Get Made, which is a hilarious podcast. Have you found, and your kids are in the sweet spot, like my daughter is five, of like, they're old enough to know something is wrong, or at least your oldest is. You're old enough to know something's wrong. Something's been disrupted, but not old enough that they have like schoolwork where you can be like, just go do your schoolwork for 4 hours, or just play Fortnite for 4 hours. So what have you done to pass the time?
Well, it's interesting because I feel like my wife and I are always talking like, oh, I wish we could freeze this time. I wish we could just like capture this moment. And then this happened and essentially we got our wish. Like we are spending, you know, 14 hours a day with our 3 and 5 year olds. So we really are getting to embrace them. And for all the insanity that is of just trying to keep them occupied, because you do have to entertain them. So right now, the best things that we've been doing that have been keeping them entertained is Legos. We've been just basically dropping Legos, and my oldest has gotten better at doing Legos, but still, you know, it's not perfect. They are literally climbing the walls. I mean that. Like there's no playgrounds aren't open. You can't go on hikes. They can't see friends. So they just are climbing the walls. And the other day, my 3-year-old fell and broke his arm. So in the middle of all of this, yes, it broke it in two spots. So that was rough, really,
hospital?
Really rough.
You got to go to the hospital,
well,
right?
We got lucky. We got to go to a child orthopedist urgent care. So they only do broken bones. It's only an urgent care for that. And there was no respiratory issues in that urgent care. So it was a very we got a few kind of green lights before we went in there, but we had to do something. It was our biggest fear. Like what would happen if our kids got hurt? And one of our kids got hurt. He's totally fine. It happened on Monday afternoon. He came home like 3 hours later. He was having a water balloon fight yesterday. Kids are super resilient, better than any adult I've ever seen. My kid is just like out there, just like fine, not worrying about the cast, not complaining about it, just living his life.
Very important. Did he get to pick the color of his cast?
Yes, he did, but he got a little bit nervous and he didn't know what to pick. So he asked what his big brother would pick. He's like, what would Gus want? And my wife was like, blue. And he's like, blue. So I don't know if he really wanted blue, but I think he just got it by default.
That my daughter was about a year and a half and I was in Salt Lake City, Utah, of all places to hang around the Jazz for a bit. And my wife called me at like 6 in the morning. So I was like, you know, it's bad. Like six in the morning, you know, it's bad. She gave me the your daughter. You'll never believe what your daughter did. She leaped out of her crib head first and broke her fall with her hand and broke a bone in her wrist. And the whole thing that saved it, they're so resilient and courageous. Like they just bounce back, but she got a purple cast. And I think she was almost sad when the purple cast came off because A, it was purple. She loves purple. And B, she realized it was also a weapon that she could use to intimidate other children.
Well, like my son, we were running around the house yesterday and he just used it to like whack his brother. And it was like, oh, it just stopped the game short because it was like, that thing is, it's like hitting somebody with a piece of like concrete. It really does hurt. It's great. So he feels like he's a robot now. He's got like a robot arm.
So ostensibly, part of the reason you are here is that Black Monday is coming back for season two, right? On Showtime.
Well, actually, Black Monday is having its mid-season finale. Yes, because we couldn't finish the show because of this. So we've aired.
I was going to ask, like, everything's up in the air, right?
Yeah, we have the first six episodes. By the time this airs, will be out, and that's great. And then we'll come back in the summer and finish the last four.
So I am always like years behind on pop culture because my pop culture is the NBA, which takes place at night when other pop culture takes place. But I am always looking for spouse-friendly viewing opportunities. And I read about Black Monday in preparation for this. This sounds like my wife doesn't want to do any violence, any like, particularly now, any like unpleasantness. This sounds like it could work. So sell me and sell the audience that hasn't seen the show on Black Monday. Cause I love Don Cheadle. I love you. Like it seems to be in my wheelhouse.
All right. Well, here's how I'll sell it. First of all, it's a show about the 80s and it's about this Wall Street firm in the 80s that are the underdogs. And it's led by Regina Hall, who is one of the funniest people hands down. You know her from movies like Scary Movie, Girls Trip. She's hilarious. Cheadle, amazing. Andrew Rannells, who you know from Girls and Book of Mormon, and me and Horatio Sanz from Saturday Night Live. And we're basically this underdog group of like traders in the 80s. And it's basically a way to look at where we are now and how far we haven't come in a way. Like, you know, like, yes, like there might have been a little bit more cocaine in the 80s. And by the way, there's a lot of cocaine in the show. There's also a Lambo Limbo, which is a Lamborghini limousine, which has all the comfort of a Lambo and all the style of a limo. I don't know. It's a really kind of funny show that I think it has like some dramatic thrust to it too. I feel like a lot of comedies are disposable. You come back every week and characters don't change. Here, you're actually following a plot like a Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul, but there's a ton of jokes in there too. Created by the guy who created Happy Endings, David Kasp, co-creator, I should say. And it's just hilarious people every single week. And you get me in roller skates.
Ooh, I don't know that I've ever roller skated in my life.
Well, for season two, my character, I won't reveal why, but my character has to rollerblade and roller skate. And I had to train with this amazing trainer. And the saddest thing ever was watching me, an adult man, learn how to roller skate in public parks around Los Angeles. As I worked with my trainer, I said to my wife, I was like, if you ever hear a story of me holding hands with a woman skating through the park, just know that was for my job. That was my
work. See, I think you need to lean all the way into that and go John Stockton shorts and socks pulled all the way up to your knees. I think you just need to lean all the way into 80s roller skating.
I mean, by the way, at this point, why not? How are we all living? I mean, what are days? What are weekends? Who knows? We're dressing in insane ways. I mean, right now, this is a time to let your freak flag fly. And I feel like a John Stockton look would actually be pretty great for me right now. I mean, have you seen what Shaq has been doing on this, like, this break? Like, he's turned his kitchen into basically a club.
I have not seen this, but I'm now. Do I need to go on Shaq's Instagram? Is that where I'm going to see this?
Yes, you're going to see disco balls in the kitchen. You're going to see dancing. Like, he is putting on a full insane show. And I want to just talk about one thing about Shaq because I'm fascinated by him and everything. but like the fact that he's in the Tiger King. Do you know about this at all? This
I know what Tiger King is.
Yes.
I feel like I'm not sure I want to watch it, but I know that Shaq had to like release a statement. Like, I actually don't know this guy. I'm not friends with this dude. Please stop asking me about this. So like, what's the story?
Well, look, it's I think you can fall in it two different ways. I mean, it's kind of a bummer of a documentary, but it came out at a time when everyone was watching Netflix. So I feel like everyone watched it. And it's a real messed up doc. But in the first episode, here's Shaq talking, like, they're basically saying like, this is a place where animals are treated terribly. It's disgusting. This man runs it in a terrible way. And then cut to Shaq on, you know, on the post NBA show going like, I met my friend Joe Exotic, who this is all about. He's like, and I saw some cats and I got there. I love my cats. Like, it's like basically a full throated endorsement of Joe Exotic in this park. Like with, and it made me laugh so hard. I was like, oh, he's never going to live this down. Like he's like, front and center. If you only watch one episode, you will see Shaq singing the praises of this man who is a legit madman.
All right. I got another reason why I have to actually participate in Instagram. I have a dark Instagram account. I swore I would never join Instagram. The ESPN people are like, can you please, even like old people have Instagram. Can you please just, and now it's just a point of pride. Like now I've protested so much. If I join, I've admitted defeat and I can't do that, but I guess I have to.
You got to piggyback over Instagram and just get into TikTok. I want to see you doing like dance videos with your family. By the way, let me ask you about that. How are you doing with being home all the time? Because this is a different like track for you a little bit, right? I mean, because I imagine you're out a bunch, you know, you're going around, like you said, you were in Utah with the Jazz. What is it like being home 24/7, not going to work?
And I'm in LA all the time. Like I'm in LA for 5-6 days a month. I was reading about, I mean, obviously I know you're a Clippers fan, but I read an interview where someone asked you, what was your favorite Clippers game you've ever been to?
Yeah.
And you mentioned their overtime win against the Celtics in November of the season. I was also at that game. That was a great game.
Such a fun game.
And it has the sensation like I work from home a lot. Like when I'm home, probably 50% of the days I'm just working from home. Okay. So I'm used to it. The balancing the childcare and work, and it's all very strange, but it also feels like this has already been going, like the NBA season feels like 6 months to a year ago already. That Clippers game feels like it was three seasons ago. It's a very strange sensation.
It's funny because you'll see different players like post a pic and it's like 3 weeks ago. I'm like, what? 3 weeks ago? Like, wait, you know, but it's true. We're in this kind of weird abyss. It's almost like my friend described it as you're doing time, but you don't know how much time you're doing. It's almost like you're in the hole in prison. It's like, I'm here. I don't know when it's day. I don't know when it's night. I'm just trying to get through it. And it's fun. You know, it's like I have so much more. I already had respect for my teachers, not my teachers, but my kids' teachers and our childcare, our amazing nanny. But now I have even more respect for them because you realize how hard it is to clean a house, take care of your kids, teach your kids, do your own work. You know, I think everyone's like under this tremendous amount of stress. I mean, yet alone have any kind of real connection with your partner because you're also like, you just have to do everything. Like you're just trying to like, at the end of the day, we both want to go to our own corners and just be like, can I just have like 5 minutes to answer an emails or like just zone out for a second?
Yeah, I'm weirdly busier because I just go from work to, okay, it's my turn with our daughter, back to work, my turn with our daughter, back to work, my turn with our daughter. Then she goes to bed and I'm like, now that the house is quiet, I got to make all these phone calls to NBA people that I've been putting off all day. And then it's 10 p.m. and I'm like, can I just have a glass of wine? And I will tell you the show. I will tell you the show that, my wife suggested, we finished The Good Place, which was one of my passion shows.
I love The Good Place.
You have been, you were on four episodes of The Good Place.
I was.
Are you a demon? But you're like turned good, right?
No, I am actually one of the very few people on the show from the actual Good Place. So I came on, I guess, the season before last as a member of the Good Place committee, which is kind of like, a little bit of a, like they were like kind of the Democrats in the world. They were very much always kind of caving and never really doing anything and just kind of getting wrapped up in their own weird logic and morals. So they were kind of like a takedown of like Chuck Schumer a little bit, I think.
So what we're watching now that I've finished with that, we've had a number of friends recommend again for spouse friendly viewing.
Yeah.
The Great British Bake Off.
Oh, well, that's a classic. Yeah.
Which I resisted and resisted because it's not something that I would be interested in. And finally my wife was like, all right, we're done with The Good Place. Great British Bake Off. You won the last argument. I win this argument.
Right.
And I'm in. I'm in for the whole season now. What they can do is, have you seen the show?
Oh, I've watched it. I love it. I mean, it's literally
incredible.
It just calms you down. And here's what I love about it. There's no prize. It's just bragging rights. It's just kind of like a very sweet, lovely show. I mean, it makes you, what Animal Crossing does for me right now, which is like this game on the Nintendo Switch, like a British Bake Off does for my wife. Just like, it's like a cigarette at the end of the day, but it's healthier and better for you.
I just watched an episode where the challenge was, you have to build a dessert. You have like 4 hours. You have to build the dessert. Then you have to build a chocolate sphere that goes around the dessert. Then you have to cook a sauce, a hot sauce that you pour over the chocolate sphere so that it crumbles in a dramatic way to reveal the dessert within. And I'm like, how can anybody do this? This is the most impossible thing I've ever heard. And they all did it.
And here's the thing. None of them are professionals. These are all hobbyists for the most part. They're not like, I own my own bakery. I have this thing. It's like, oh, I'm in my town. People know that I like to cook. It's like, and that's what I love about this show. Brits have talent. By the way, the show that I've been watching with my family, we have two big like family shows. One I'm completely sick of, American Ninja Warrior. My 5-year-old like loves American Ninja Warrior, and especially American Ninja Warrior Jr., which has the most depressing backstories that you'll ever see. Like I'm explaining things to my kids that I'm like, okay, so what does that mean? Well, it means, his dad was shot in the middle of the street. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, and what's a gun? Okay. So we're explaining like the darkest backstories, but then the kids are amazing. And the other show that we've been watching, which I kind of love, is Lego Masters, which is the same idea as British Bake Off. It's people who love to build Legos, and they have these challenges, and they have like 12 hours to completely design and build their own Legos. It's hosted by Will Arnett, who plays Lego Batman. And it's so much fun, and it's people of all different ages at just, you know, building Legos.
People who can build amazing things with Legos, like one of the museums in New York recently, I think it was the Museum of the Moving Image or something, had a Lego art exhibit where there's like Van Gogh paintings, but out of Legos, and giant sculptures out of Legos. Like, this is incredible. People are incredible.
We have that here now. Well, I guess we would have that here now. I just see posting. Yeah. Nothing's open anymore. Yeah.
Let's talk Clippers, because you just said something. You said something about an underdog before, and I was reading about you and the Clippers, and you initially gravitated toward the Clippers because you moved from New York as a Knicks fan to LA, and you're like, I got to have a team. I got to have one of the teams. It can't be the Lakers. I want the underdog. But now the Clippers are not underdogs. Now the Clippers are I picked them to win the championship this year. And you can even see the team internally this year. The holdover guys like Harrell in particular would be like, these new guys don't know how we played last year. They don't know what it was like. How have you as a fan handled the transition from lovable loser to, oh, now we're a juggernaut?
You know, I think what really worried me, first of all, when the season started was all the press that they were getting. Like when they're on the cover of Sports Illustrated, I was like, ooh, okay, this is nerve-wracking, because it's sort of that thing of this expectation. And I never thought the Clippers were going to come out of the gate and be a team that were just going to be like the way the Lakers kind of came out. You know, there's like just this crazy run. I think they were going to have to figure things out. They were making a huge transition by adding two giant pieces into their organization, and also two quiet pieces. They're not a mouthpiece team, you know, so those two guys are quiet. So that's there's going to be a lot of, they're going to be under a microscope. And I think wherever Kawhi went, it was like, did it work? Did it work? Did it work? Like this aggressive nature to it. Where meanwhile, if LeBron goes to the Lakers, no one really has that sort of energy. So I was okay to watch and just kind of sit back. And I love seeing the games. I knew that Paul George was going to come in a little bit late. But to me, the core of the team, the people that I love and have been watching kind of grow, are all still there. I mean, it's like Pat Bev is the guy. I love Pat
Bev. You love Pat Bev. You're a big Pat Bev guy.
I'm a big Pat Bev guy. I love Trez. I love Lou. And to see all these guys, I feel like it was working. And I think Zoo came up and was doing really great. And I feel like they were just getting their stride here at the end of the season. And I feel like Kawhi is very zen about where they were going. So I've just been cautiously optimistic. Happy, but you're right. I'm watching this team now become a contender, and I'm happy they're becoming a contender, but you can't imagine the amount of anger that I get thrown at me for being a Clippers fan. And it's crazy because I've been a Knicks fan. I've been a Jets fan. You know, I grew up in New York City, and my dad had a store in the Bronx. And I would work with my dad in the Bronx all the time when I was a kid, and we'd go see the Yankees, and the Yankees sucked. I saw them when it was like Dave Winfield, Don Mattingly. You know,
we're about the same age, and I grew up hating the Yankees, and I grew up in the only time that it was like safe to hate the Yankees because they were bad. Like I grew up when the Yankees, like Mel Hall, like, you know, all that. Like, I grew up with that. I was like, this is paradise. I didn't remember a time when the Yankees were good. And then from 96 on, I was like, oh, this is just what life has been like for everybody for the most of the last 100 years.
And that was the crazy thing. So I was a Yankee fan when they were not. They were just like, oh, I love the Yankees. So my dad loved the Yankees, and we would go see the Yankees, but it wasn't a big deal. Now they're like, you know, a juggernaut, you know, and it's, I don't know. For me, it's fun to watch these teams transition, but the minute you see a team get any heat, there's an automatic anger at it. Like I've never gotten grief for being a Knicks fan when I was in New York. No one ever talked about that at all. Like, it was like, oh, they suck or whatever. But when you're a Clippers fan, people come at you. And I think a lot of it is like a Laker fans, which I don't understand, because like, you got your banners, you're fine. Like, don't worry about us. We're okay over here.
I think first of all, Lakers fans are very, this is their town. LA is their town. Mm-hmm. They own it. You're trying to steal the Forum. You're trying to steal fans. You're trying to be, and I've said this many times, I loved how the Clippers leaned into in their marketing. Like, mm-hmm. I don't remember what the slogans are, but it's all about
we over me, you know, street lights over spotlights. And it's aggressive.
They leaned right into it. They leaned right into, like, we're the anti-Lakers.
To me, what I always say about the Clippers and the Lakers are, the Lakers are a Hollywood team. That's everything that you know about, like, showbiz and big movies and everything like that. Like, that's the energy that they project. And the Clippers are an LA team. And I feel like they are just driving home, like, we're going to improve the courts. We're going to build this amazing stadium, and we're going to make it have an infrastructure around it. We can bring kids into it. Like, I feel like in 10 years, the Clippers organization, if Steve Ballmer continues on this path that he's doing, is going to bring in more fans for the Clippers, regardless of the championships, if they get them, or the players, just by actually injecting themselves into the community. I think that that's what I really have been appreciating. I think, you know, that they've really made a strong stand in, like, saying, we're going to be LA's team. Even if you, like, you know, even though the Lakers are here, it's like, you're always going to be under their shadow. So how can you do it a little bit differently?
Where were you and what did you do the moment at, I think it was about 11 o'clock LA time, 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. New York time, where the tweets came through and it was like, Kawhi, Paul George, what is happening? What's going on? They got both of them. So what were you doing?
Okay. I was away with my wife. We were in North Carolina, very much in the forest of North Carolina, so much so we didn't get like really strong cell signals. And we were on a family trip, and it was this week leading up to this decision, you know, and it was just reading everybody, you know, what's going on? Who's saying this? Every rumor on Twitter, getting involved, reading articles. And I was sneaking away at certain points during our vacation just to check Twitter and see, did it happen? And I went through so many ups and downs, like, it's not going to happen. You know what? You know, and fine, if it doesn't happen, we still got our core, and that was a fun season, and we're going to build on it. We're going to make a good choice, and we got the logo. It'll be good. And then I went to bed the night before we're going to come home. I'm in bed, and I just wake up in the middle of the night. The craziest thing, I just wake up in the middle of the night, and I see a text from my buddy, a Clippers fan, and it just says, we got him. And then as if, just like an avalanche started happening. It was like, brrr, like just all these texts came in, all the Twitter reports come in. I felt like I was psychically connected to Clipper Nation in this one moment, because I woke up right as it happened and then stayed up from like 2 a.m. till we had to catch our flight at like 6 a.m, just in bed trying to wake up my wife. I'm like, babe, we got PG, we got Kawhi. And she's like, I don't care. And just let me go back to bed. I was like literally like lifted above my bed. I was so psyched because this whole week, and I had packed all my Clippers gear, and I was proudly wearing all my Clippers stuff to the airport, just walking around prepped for it, ready to go. But yeah, it was exciting. And you know, as a fan of an underdog team, it's like, I want that win. It's like, I think there's an energy also where it's like, when your underdog team makes a move like that, it's like, no, you have to stay underdogs. No, we can move up. I've just finished reading The Curse by Nick Minas, and I was like, we've taken a beating for a very long time. We can stand up a little bit now. It's okay.
Well, the most excited I've ever been as a sports fan. I grew up a Mets fan, and you know, so they won the World Series when I was 8 years old, 9 years
yes.
old, in '86, and then they were, you know, up and down, but you know, they're the Clippers of New York. They're the second class baseball team, and that you feel that chip on your shoulder. I was in college when they traded for Mike Piazza. That was the moment where I was most excited. It's like, we don't get guys like Mike Piazza. We don't get that guy. And now we got, and there was like rumors. Remember, he was like a Marlin for a second.
Yes, yes.
And then there were rumors the Mets were interested. And I was like, there was no Twitter then. I was just like refreshing ESPN.com every hour being like, did we get him? Did we get him? Then we got him. And I remember walking around, like, I got together with my other Met fans. We like high five. It was the most exciting thing that ever happened to me as a sports fan.
No, it's so fun to see that community. I think the one good thing about Twitter, you know, and it's a cesspool, obviously, but one of the greatest things about it was being able to share that moment even though I was alone in a bed in North Carolina, you know, I was able to feel like I was a part of this like giant celebration, all these text chains, all these, you know, emails and everything, and just kind of having fun on Twitter. And like, that is to me, like the moment that Twitter is so worth it when you're kind of isolated. And especially now we're in this moment of like social distancing. We can't really be together. So it's fun to be able to connect in these ways. I mean, that's, I think, the best part of it, but it also is nerve wracking because the rumors are flying so much harder during, you know, like Mike Piazza, you would have been having like 4 days of anxiety of it, like leading up to it now with the, you know, every piece of information.
In terms of just how fast things change, I was watching you appear on some, I can't remember. I watched so many clips of you just to refresh my memory. We were appearing on some show and it was May, 2017. Mm-hmm. I think it was Desus and Miro maybe.
Oh yeah.
You made a pitch like, we got to get Melo to the Clippers. May 2017, 1 month later, Chris Paul is traded to the Rockets in the first step of the dismantling of that Clippers. But at that moment, you still had the Lob City Clippers. And your dream was like, if we get Melo to the Lob City Clippers, we're set. And now it's like 2.5 years later, it's all completely different.
Oh, it's so crazy. I remember being so passionate about that. And that's the thing, you kind of figure it out. I mean, that dismantling of the Lob City Clippers was, I mean, really epic. And even what they did last season, like being a Clippers fan in the last like 3 or 4 years has been really hard because you're seeing like these pieces that you really connect to. You know, for me, like I love DeAndre Jordan, and obviously like you see, you know, Blake Griffin, like all these guys, and you have to like justify them leaving. Even like Boban, like, you know, and Tobias, like you're just like, oh, but I like, you're watching the good players just go in the hopes that you get something better, you know? And it's been working out, but it's nerve wracking though to see, things just flutter away. I mean, I remember that bring Melo to the Clippers.
It's amazing how when the Chris Paul trade happened, mm-hmm. Chris Paul was such the headliner. And like, what does this mean for the Rockets? How's he going to fit with Harden? Is this the end of the Clippers? And I think all of us at the moment were like, there was a vague awareness, like, actually all these players the Clippers got are pretty good. Like, I always liked Harrell. I thought Harrell, if he got a bigger role, would be decent in the NBA. And now it's amazing to look back, like, the Clippers might have won that trade. I mean, that they got a lot of stuff in that trade. All those dudes are, Pat Bev was in that trade. Like, they got a lot of stuff.
I think the thing is about the Clippers is they, and maybe I'm just a fan and I'm overly excited about them, but I think that they thrive on the underdog mentality. And by when you put a guy like, Pat Bev on the organization, when you bring Trez in, they're working harder to a certain extent because they have something to prove and they want to prove that they are worthy of being there so that team really works. And then when you bring in like Kawhi and Paul George, who are quieter guys who also really work, I think it creates this ethic of like, we're just grinding. We're just trying to grind it. And it's like Trez's game got so much better in the last year. And you even watch like people like Zoo was doing great like this year.
Zoo's good.
It's like, and it's like, but like these players are blossoming in a way that they didn't really get a chance to blossom. And, you know, to me, the biggest bummer is that we lost, you know, Shea. I mean, cause Shea, like, I feel like was the guy that I feel like was going to be great in that organization, but you know, you gotta, to make an omelet, you gotta crack a few eggs. I mean, you know, people want to say like, oh, we lost that trade. You lost that trade because Shea's so good. But you know what? PG is good and he was good this season. I think he was like almost his defensive game was really good, but people are just, I think like to just kind of give him, you know, give him, grief. I don't know.
Well, I think if you power ranked the teams of like, who does it hurt most if there are no playoffs this year? Yeah. I think most people would default to the Bucks because of Giannis's pending supermax thing. And like, you know, if they had won the championship, that solves everything for them. Then I think most people would go to Lakers just because everyone is obsessed. Like, how many years does LeBron have left? How many shots does LeBron have left? But honestly, with everything the Clippers gave up and PG and Kawhi are like 29, 30. I don't have it in front of me. They're approaching like the end of their primes. They're on 2-year contracts. Like the Clippers can't afford to lose a chance to win the championship. Like they're right at the top of those rankings.
No, I mean, they basically backed themselves into a very specific corner for like a 2-year game plan. And now potentially, I mean, they've lost one of those years. And then you're also in this zone where it's like, well, now do we keep Trez? I mean, can we keep Trez? And, you know, it's like there's some issues now. It was a smart plan if we were not in the middle of a pandemic. But now, yeah, you're right. It's like, it's crazy. And the way the NBA has been, you can't kind of keep track of it. I mean, you know, like with Giannis, it's like, oh, I wonder where he goes. Like, you know, I mean, does he go to like Golden State? I mean, that would be an interesting play there. Like, you know, I mean, and then there was a talk that he was going to the Lakers the other day too. It's like, well, what, everyone, you know, there's always this. I mean, it's going to be an interesting thing.
The longer there are no games, the crazier the rumor mill is going to get. Like, we need games just to stop all of that stuff from getting.
You're
like,
right.
What if Giannis, like, would Giannis go to the Pistons? Like, well, they have caps, but like, wait, maybe, you know, this is going to get crazier and crazier. Let's talk about comedy. I first started watching you when you were on Human Giant, which feels like a gazillion years ago. It was Aziz Ansari, Rob Hubel. You were before that. You started at Upright Citizens Brigade.
Yeah.
In the late 90s. When you guys were all essentially building that together, and Amy Poehler, I think, came like 2 or 3 years before you. So you've told some stories about early UCB, but when you get there, what is Amy Poehler's status in the world of UCB? I mean, it's starting to happen. Like, the Comedy Central show is going to happen soon.
Right.
But what do you remember of her at that time and just sort of like the vibe of that theater? Like, I started going to shows at UCB maybe 2004, 2005. And by that time, there's a line out the door. It's a whole big thing. Everybody in New York knows about it. But what do you remember initially?
Well, okay. So I was doing improv at this Upper East Side comedy club called Chicago City Limits. It was in New York, but it was called Chicago City Limits. It was the bane of that place's existence because it made no sense. But I was doing like short form comedy, like Whose Line Is It Anyway? Like, every time a bell rings, you're going to change the last thing you said, you know, very basic gamey improv. And, one time I had heard, I was like, hey, you know, there's this group in town. They're called the Upright Citizens Brigade, and they do like a free show on Sunday nights. It's great. You should go see them. So I went with like a handful of my friends, to this abandoned hardware store. We walked up the most rickety flight of stairs, like 5 flights, to get to this top loft. And I watched this free improv show, and the whole thing was like, it's free to get in and you have to pay to leave. And you watched like for, you know, an hour, this group, and it was the UCB Four, which is Matt Besser, Matt Walsh, Ian Roberts, and Amy Poehler with their friends. And their friends were Tina Fey, Rachel Dratch, Adam McKay, but they were not Tina Fey, Adam McKay, Rachel Dratch. They were just perform. They were just, hey, out of Chicago trying like, oh, I write on SNL. I do this. And you watch these shows and they were just blowing you away. Like, they were just so funny. It was so different. And they do this improv called long form improv, which, you know, you take one suggestion and you go for about 45 minutes. Whereas I was taking at short form, like a suggestion every like 2 minutes. But when I saw it, it was like, whoa, these guys just were the funniest group I've ever seen. I saw their sketch show. And then when I saw their sketch show, it said, you know, we teach classes. Take classes with us. So I got into a class, and because I'd been doing improv, I took a class with Matt Besser, who was the high level teacher. Amy Poehler was the low level teacher.
Wow.
And that was it. We were in that first round of classes and we were watching them and taking classes with them. And it was a small group. I think at the beginning, you know, my grouping of UCB, I would say we're probably, you know, 25, 45 strong. I mean, it was like, you know, it was a very tight knit organization. And obviously Amy and Matt and Ian were kind of above us. Like, that we were aspiring to be them, and they were working on their own things, but they were focused on being the UCB. So you just wanted to be around them. I mean, and for me, Amy was the most accessible, like I thought like one of the funniest people I've ever seen. And you just wanted to kind of like be able to, you were at parties with them and just kind of get a casual conversation going. You know, it was just sort of like this connection. You know, they were our superstars. But yet we were in such a small group that, you know, everybody I perform with now, whether it's, you know, Rob Riggle, who, you know, from a million different things, or, you know, Rob Hubel, or, you know, gosh, Ed Helms, Rob Corddry, like all these people, we started out together doing shows 7 nights a week. Sometimes 2 shows a night just to keep the theater afloat, and not in a bad way. It's just sort of like, that's all they had. So we had to do multiple shows to, you know, $5 shows. It was a really fun, exciting time. I feel like I got my education in comedy by training with them and working that hard with them. I mean, we painted the walls, we cleaned the bathrooms, and we did shows. it was kind of like, it was kind of in a way, this like summer camp of comedy.
You probably at that stage, you're having fun and you're grinding and you're starting out making no money. You probably never imagine like, some of us are really going to make it. Like we're going to be on big TV shows and we're going to write on it. We're going to be on Amy Poehler ends up being a gigantic star. It's probably just not in your headspace that these things are really possible. Like, yeah, you have a dream. They're vague dreams, but like, so when the first people start to make it and you see Amy become successful and you see other of your friends become like, oh, they're on SNL, they're doing this. Is there like a sensation of, whoa, this is like, we actually might be able to make something out of this?
The moment that it all changed for me, we were all doing Conan bits, and that was a big thing. Like, so Conan used to have like all these like hilarious, like kind of weird sketch comedy bits, like staring contest, where you just basically get in a costume and do something weird behind like Andy or Conan, or you just come out and say one line. And those were like, oh my gosh, I'm on Conan night. And I have a VHS tape of all the times I was on Conan, because it was like such a big deal, and you'd actually get paid and the money was actually really good. Good for whatever you need the money to be.
Yeah.
But at that point, the thing that changed, everything changed for me the night when Lauren Michaels decided to come to UCB the first time. And Lauren Michaels came and we put on a showcase. And
I can't imagine Lauren Michaels sitting in that little theater with dusty floors and people drinking beer out of cans and all that.
It was so crazy. And like, you know, like limos pulled up outside and they all came in and we did this like show. And I was in that show and he brought me into audition for SNL. It was actually the same year that Amy auditioned for SNL, although Amy, I think, was just like a shoo-in because she'd already done UCB, the TV show, and I think they really just wanted her. But it was me. I remember this. Me, Kevin Hart, Amy Poehler, all in three dressing rooms next to each other, auditioning for SNL. I was like, oh shit, this is like a moment where you can actually, like something can happen here. Like this is like all of a sudden it became like real. And that was a really, really big moment for me. And I think one thing that UCB really taught me was develop your own stuff, write your own stuff, produce your own stuff, and always count on yourself. I auditioned for SNL a handful of times, but there came a moment where I had a big opportunity to do a big network show. And I also had this moment to do my own show. And that was with Rob and Aziz, this Human Giant show. And the money on the network show was so amazing. And the people behind the network show were so great. And I chose to do Human Giant over that network show. And I kind of feel like that's what I've followed my whole career, is like kind of betting on myself and trying to do the things that I think I could be really proud of and have a little bit of control over. And so, I think UCB instilled these two things. Like, yes, it's possible for you to get these bigger opportunities, but also you have to control those opportunities. You just can't wait for somebody to give them to you, because I'd also see friends who would kind of be the funniest person you would see on stage, and then they would kind of get on something and fizzle out, not by their own issue. It's just like, if you're not getting your voice out the right way, that's it. You know, it's sort of like if you a square peg round hole kind of a thing.
I am now going to refer to you, since you said bet on yourself, as the Fred Van Vliet of comedy, because he bet on himself. He's now an NBA champion.
Yes.
Make a lot of money. So you are going to be the Fred Van Vliet. What did you do on your SNL audition? What was your best or worst SNL audition? Okay, what did you do?
I auditioned a handful of times, and each time was a very different time. My favorite one was when he brought me in on my literal birthday, and I missed my own birthday party to meet with Lauren Michaels. And when I got
there, you have to miss your own birthday party.
I didn't care about it at all. And when I got brought into 30 Rock, to go meet him, they greeted me in the lobby and they said, okay, hey, so, Lauren really wants to meet with you. He's running, 6 hours behind. It was such a specific time, like 6 hours. And I had and at that point, I was living on 50th and 8th. I could walk home. It's like, well, I'll go home and I'll just come back in like 4 hours. And they're like, no, he really wants you to stay here. And I was like, okay. So I just basically sat in a room for 6 hours, waiting for Lauren Michaels, which, by the way, I would do. If you asked me to do that right now, I'd do it. He's amazing. But But my favorite thing I did in my first SNL audition, and it's ballsier than anything they probably would have done now. You know, you're coming up with like, you're coming up with characters and impressions. And I was like, let me just do like a funny, weird one. And one of my, my weird ones was a panda bear in First Class. And that, I get on stage. I'm like, all right, so now, my next character is a panda bear in First Class. And I just like I would just put my hand up and press like the overhead button. And I was like, ding. And I was like, can I have some champagne? And that was it. I was like, I'm just doing something weird. And I didn't even know why it was just like a weird thing. And I did get a laugh. I feel like Panda Bear in First Class got a laugh.
Did you ever ask for a bamboo, or did you intentionally I'm going the other way and I'm going to ask for things that Panda Bears will never ask?
No,
for.
I only did one joke, champagne. And then I was like, thank you. I just moved off of it. But it was really fun. And, you know, and I think I learned, you know, later on, many, many years later, almost like 2 years ago, that I was very, like, it was down to me and somebody else and Lauren over dinner. I was like, I think we'll bring that other person in. And it was like, so I could have gotten it. And I'm so glad I didn't. I love SNL. I love those people. I love that show. I love the history of it, but I got to do my own sketch show. And that to me is, I carry that so much, I carry so much pride in that. And, you know, and yeah, it's just more fun.
I don't know the origin of this character. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it originated on Human Giant, or not, but one of the funniest characters from the Human Giant universe at that mm-hmm. time was, I vividly remember going to the movies and seeing, you know, you watch the trailers mm-hmm. and then there's always the notification, turn off your cell phones.
Right.
And just first time I saw Rob Hubel as irritating cell phone guy.
Yes.
Because instead of just the please silence your cell phones, they have this sketch of a minute and a half of Rob Hubel doing really irritating things as a guy on his cell phone. And it's like the irritating cell phone guy.
Yeah. Yes.
And, like, he was so funny in that. Like, I just like, how did that happen? Anyone remember it? No one even going to go to the movies ever again. Were you aware of it? It was such a great character.
Well, yeah, I think there's a couple things at play here. First of all, I may be mistaken, but I think I'm right. It only ran on the East Coast, right? So not many people have.
I think there were only two versions of it ever.
Yes, there's one with karate. But no, I remember it. I remember it because it was like, the AMC by my house. I saw him there all the time, but Rob was also my buddy at that point. Rob was the commercial guy. If you look at like Rob's history, like his beginning of his career, he was nailing commercials. He had a great look and he looked like middle America kind of dad but cool and hip. And he was just nailing commercials, but he's also like ridiculously funny and such a good improviser. And I think he would go into all these auditions and just improvise the hell out of it. And that's how he got it. But you know, Rob was like a producer for Michael Moore, on The Awful Truth. He was like a producer for like Metro Channel. Like he was doing this on the side and he started getting these big gigs. And that one, I think, you know, is like a lot of these things, it doesn't pay really well, but everyone sees it. So everyone knew him as the irritating cell phone guy. I remember his mom had like a poster of it in her house, like, cause they made like funny posters of the irritating cell phone guy. And we used to give Rob shit because when, Human Giant first started, he was in an Olive Garden commercial and we were trying to do this like cool, edgy show. I mean, not trying to do an edgy show, but we were like, fuck everything. We're a Human Giant. We're going against the grain. And Rob was in a commercial where it's like, they come to Olive Garden and he's like, we're treating ourselves. Like, what's a special occasion? We're treating ourselves. And it was like, so like smiley and cornball-y. It was so hilarious, but it was like, we were doing the exact opposite of that. And I think we made him not renew his Olive Garden contract. Like, dude, you can't be seen on TV because it aired during every football game. It played like five times. And we're like, you can't be seen on TV like that. We're trying to do something different. You can't do it. And like Rob like turned down so much money because we were like, we have to have an image. And they literally canceled this commercial because you can re-up your commercial. Like if you don't agree to extend it, they can't air it anymore. So Rob didn't agree to extend the commercial. And then they literally reshot the commercial with the exact same people, just replaced Rob. And then the commercial went on for years, like literally years. Like Rob could have made so much more money if we did not peer pressure.
Definitely 22-year-old Zach Lowe had a first date at the Olive Garden in Williamsburg, Virginia, and thought that I was really just like, this is a home run. Like, I'm gonna nail this.
Oh, I mean, look, I remember going to Chevy's in 42nd Street in New York City, like, and going like, this is real Mexican food. I mean, yeah, you know, what can we do? I can't blame ourselves. I did a movie, this terrible movie, not terrible. It's actually a fun movie. It's called Piranha 3D. It was like a horror movie directed by this guy, Alex Aja. Fun experience. But I was living down in Lake Havasu, Arizona, and the only place that you could eat was a TGI Fridays. And I started like eating there all the time, because it was like the only place to get food, because we would wrap so late. And I remember I brought my wife down there. She wasn't my wife at this point. I was like, babe, we got to go here. And I brought her to TGI Fridays as if I was bringing her to like the most expensive restaurant. And she like looked at me and she's like, she's like, you're eating trash. You're becoming trash. Cause I was like, literally, like, better. I was like, yeah, it's like, do better. And it was a good moment, but I was like, this is the best. It's got so much good stuff. What do you want? You want the appetizer sampler? I'll splurge. We'll get it.
So I just remember, I don't know if the irritating cell phone guy predates Human Giant, is contemporary Human Giant. I don't know if that made me aware of Rob and that I wanted to do more, but I just, the line where he's waving obnoxiously in a crowd and he says, I'm the guy in the suit waving. I just almost fell out of my chair laughing so hard. So that brings me to a comedy question.
Yes.
Rob is really good, and Rob Riggle is also really good at playing arrogant asshole guy. And I feel like that's such, like, so many comedians, like, that's Vince Vaughn's guy. Vince Vaughn made a career out of playing arrogant asshole guy. You have played that guy, including in the season finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm, but you're also very good at playing normal guy and sometimes even like sad, pathetic guy. So why is the obnoxious asshole guy such an appealing trope? Why are so many comedians good at that? And why does it work? It's just everyone can play that and play like Rob Riggle is that guy a lot, and he's super funny at it.
I think it's interesting. Like, there's so few kind of archetypes for comedy. Ultimately, like, you're going to be falling in high status or low status. Like, that's the two sides of it. Like, high status, low status are straight man, right? So straight man is somebody that, stuff is done to, and you're reacting like, I can't believe it. What is going on? You're the voice of reason. Then high status often is variations on this asshole character. It's like, hey, I don't give a shit. I'll come over here. I'll piss over here. You know, it's like, so, and then that's one version of it. And then low status is just the person who is just kind of this mess, you know, quiet, like getting lost a different way. So I feel like there's only three roles that you can kind of play. And, you know, I think for Rob Riggle's side, it's not super size. It's not super believable for him to be super low status, although I find it funny when he is. He's a bombastic guy. He's a Marine. He just can kind of bring this energy. And Rob Hubel and Rob Riggle did a sketch show together that you probably saw when you were in UCB. Like, it was called Kung Fu Grip, and the title tells you everything. It was just these two guys that were just barreling through everything. I mean, one of my favorite sketches from that show was the two of them being the exes of a girl who's getting married and giving toasts at her wedding. And so the sketch was just two of them sitting there. And so when I got married, I wanted to do something kind of special and different. And so the night before I got married, I built a stage and a microphone, and I let it open to anybody who wants to do bits. And everyone got up and like got all their bits out before my actual wedding. And Rob just did one of those great things where he just started pleading with my wife, please, I know we had something like, please take me back. Like, it was so fun. And like, you know, but Rob, and then you see Rob on a show like Transparent, and he can kind of transform into something completely different. But yeah, I think it's just sort of like what archetypes you kind of find comfortable, and then how people view you too. I think people always view Rob Riggle as a Marine. And so when you're a Marine, it's like, you got to be high status, because everyone feels like, how can you compete?
Yeah, it's got to be tempting to just sort of lean into that over and over again. And probably you feel an impulse to like, okay, I've done that enough. I don't want to just be that guy all the time.
Yeah.
So you have to go soon, but I have to ask you before you go. You were on 30 Rock. How many episodes of 30 Rock? Like four or five?
A couple, maybe. Yeah, sure. No, less, I think. But people remember it as more, and I am happy.
The page off. People remember the page off with Jack McBrayer.
Yes.
30 Rock can go joke for joke with anything that has ever been produced in the history of Earth. I mean, 30 right. Rock as a joke production machine is unbelievable. And I was under the weather last week and up in bed, and I've treated myself one night to I just started going in a 30 Rock like YouTube rabbit hole.
Fun, yeah.
I'm like, man, there are so many good jokes. So what's your best 30 Rock memory? What was it like on set? I mean, I don't know if there was a something that was cut out where you guys improvised for a while that killed you.
I think my favorite 30 Rock memory ultimately was, getting to do this show at a point when no one knew what 30 Rock was, right? Like when I did 30 Rock for the first time, the big talk in the industry and, was about Aaron Sorkin's Studio 60 on the, or whatever that show was, his SNL show on the Sunset Strip, right? And so everyone's like, that show is going to be a hit. It's Aaron Sorkin. It's West Wing. So 30 Rock was literally this, again, an underdog that no one really paid that much attention to. And especially like, oh, it's Tina's show and we love Tina. But Tina wasn't like at that point, she was amazing on SNL. But, you realize now like 30 Rock is part of the conversation as one of the best shows on in the top 10, top five, whatever you want to call it. But at that point when I got to do it, it was sort of like, oh, Tina's doing this awesome show. And the reason why I'm on that show is because Jack McBrayer and I used to do improv together. We did a two-man improv show. And when they wanted to find his nemesis, they're like, oh, we'll bring Paul in because it'll do it. Like there wasn't an audition. It was just sort of like, come on and do the show. There was no pressure. I mean, I was nervous because I wanted to do a good job, and I am in awe of Tina Fey. So I want to make sure that she's happy with what I'm doing. But it wasn't like, I got to bring it because it's 30 Rock, and I feel like there's a lot of energy sometimes. Like I felt like that more on The Good Place. It's like, I can't screw this up. I have to make sure like I'm in one of these final episodes and across that season. So for me, what was so fun was when you get there, the energy that was created, which was incredibly playful. It was so much fun. And honestly, the craziest thing I remember about being there was it was the final season of The Sopranos. And to get into the building was so hard because they were trying to avoid spoilers for The Sopranos. And it was like just to get up to the different level. And then like, I remember we were coming up and down the elevator and the doors open and then you see like the cast of The Sopranos there. So it's not really a 30 Rock memory, but it was also like a moment to get involved with the, just to kind of be around The Sopranos tangentially, and be in this like thing where they're shooting their final season.
Last question. I'll let you go. You have done so much in comedy. You have a podcast that's all about bad movies, which, yes, by the way, how did this get made with June and then Jason Mantzoukas?
Yeah.
Who, Jason Mantzoukas is just a ball of energy. You throw him, he just explodes with energy.
I mean, yeah.
The episode you did at All Star Weekend about Space Jam, nothing has ever spoken to me more than that episode. I felt seen. As the kids say, I felt seen. Space Jam is bad. Space Jam is a bad movie. And I just can't believe that anyone thinks Space Jam is good. But okay, forget. So everyone should listen to How Did This Get Made? You did skits called Shutterbugs where you play a mean and ultra competitive agents for child actors way back in the day. I watched a whole skit yesterday that I'd never seen before on Human Giant. That is just based entirely around the idea that your job is to eat corn chowder all day long.
So,
So what is the craziest idea for a sketch or a character that you never got to do for whatever reason that you are absolutely 100% sure would kill if you did it?
All right. Well, I mean, here's an idea that I always tried to do and I could never quite break it. It was the idea that, you know how you would buy like in back in the day, like you'd get all excited on TV, like you'd be like, you see like the Nordotrack on TV and be like, I'm going to do that. I'm gonna be the Nordotrack guy. And you buy this Nordotrack and you're like, it's okay. It's like, yes, it's $1,500, but it's going to be worth it because I'm going to be in shape. And you convince yourself of this thing and then you don't do it and you kind of throw it in the closet. And then it's a sort of a clothes rack. So I had that idea for like, it's so dumb as I'm saying it. I'm losing faith in my pitch as I'm saying it. for a genie head, a genie in the box, right? So like Pee-Wee's Playhouse. I was like, all right, so this guy like bought a genie head and he just kind of threw it in the closet and it's like, and it's just gotten old in the closet because it doesn't really kind of work the right way. And I was just convinced it was like such a funny idea that like oh yeah, that's just my genie head. I don't know how to work it. And it was sort of like this like piece of tech that you had that, and it didn't really work and you could never figure out how to get a wish. And every time you would like futz with it, it would like mess up and you're like, ah, hate this genie head. Like it was sort of like a piece of bad tech that you bought, but yet it was this magical sorcerer that would just be f***ing up your life and your house and your everything. Your friend's like, no, well, take it out. I want to see it. Let me show you. Show me how it works. I'm like, it doesn't work. It's like, but it's magical. But yeah, but it's messed up. And that was like the idea that I really wanted to do. And as I'm articulating it, it's like, I don't know what the sketch is, but, you know,
I think you have the juice now to get this done. Anyway, you've got to go. This has been so fun for me because like I really am into the art of comedy. Like I had Gary Goldman on my podcast a couple
months ago. Oh my gosh. One of the best.
We deconstructed some of his jokes. It's something I always been fascinated with. So I've watched you for a long time. I hope we can say hello at a Clippers game.
I would love it.
I hope that for your sake and the Clippers' sake that we get something out of this season. But Paul Scheer, watch him in Black Monday. You will see him in a million other things. Listen to his two podcasts, How Did This Get Made, about bad movies like Space Jam, and Unspooled, about good movies. It's such a pleasure to see you. Congrats on everything.
Oh, thanks so much.
Good luck riding all this out with your family. Stay safe.
You too. Thanks so much.